On the occasion of George W. Bush's second inaugural, the national debt was $7.8 trillion. If we include both the debt held by the public, $4.6 trillion, and the debt held by government agencies, $3.2 trillion, principally the Social Security and Medicare trust funds. To those who counted nothing else, that total represented just 70% or so of the projected 2005 GDP. The threshold of real danger, experts agreed, came when government debt climbed into the range of 100 to 150% of GDP. Britain's national debt had reached 200% of GDP during the 18th century and roughly 300% around 1820, neither of which encumbrances kept the United Kingdom from achieving its historical zenith and economic golden age between 1850 and 1870. Under certain circumstances, then, even levels over 200% could be managed successfully, especially in a manufacturing boom. However, economists and journalists venturing a calculus for the U.S. debt usually weigh several additions. Given our federal system, combined state and local debt in the neighborhood of $1.7 trillion seems to warrant inclusion. A second plausible addition is the $3.7 trillion needed to make up a shortfall in the Social Security Trust Fund to cover its expected obligations over the next 75 years. Including these raised the 2005 national debt to $13.5 trillion, a total representing 115% of GDP and approaching the danger zone. The other possible add-on involved the expected obligations of Medicare funding over the next 75 years. These the New York Times described as follows. Because nearly everyone expects health care costs to keep rising faster than economic growth, the trustees of the Medicare Fund warn that the nation faces an enormous shortfall. They report that the country would have to pay in $9 trillion today to make the trust fund big enough to cover its future obligations, and set aside an additional $21 trillion to cover supplementary obligations, for example, the prescription drug benefit, that lie outside the scope of the trust fund. Against the backdrop of the national debts of Spain, the Dutch Republic, and Britain in their later days as great powers, including this $30 trillion, seems excessive. 18th and 19th century calculations never extended so far ahead. Even the 75-year cost of Social Security is a reach, but the Medicare obligation is too remote and also susceptible to a major policy shift toward national health insurance and drug price controls. What also seems untenable is to isolate public debt from private debt. Too many critical interrelationships have developed over the last century, especially in the United States. No historical private debt comparisons are plausible, even with the Britain of 1913. There, only 10% of the population owned homes, limiting real estate borrowing. Debtors' prisons had functioned well into the 19th century, and a fair part of private debt was extended within families. The total assets of British building societies, the housing lenders, in 1913 were just £65 million, $325 million. This equaled less than 2% of the £4 billion in overseas investments principally held by the rentier class. This £4 billion was four times the size of the British national debt. These assets were Britannia's financial shield. In the 19th century United States, by contrast, much of the private lending and debt involved homes, lands, and crops in a society of a moving frontier, in which many adult white males voted and owned some acreage. Cheap credit and easy money became a democratic, and capital D, democratic, war cry from Andrew Jackson to William Jennings Bryan, both famous as bank bashers outraged over the machinations of the moneyed classes. The millions of farmers, Bryan told the 1896 Democratic National Convention, were businessmen too. Indeed, by 1914, the total of farm mortgage debt alone was $4.5 billion. Lending to the masses has long had its greatest commercial emphasis in the United States.